This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the blatant coup d'etat by the U.S. in oil-rich Venezuela.
The U.S. government makes no bones about it. They want to overthrow the government in Venezuela, which was elected democratically, and then move on from there to Cuba and Nicaragua, and really roll back all the social and political progress that's been made in Latin America over the last 60 years since the Cuban Revolution.
We've heard a lot lately about the president and his power to declare a national emergency.
It's a plenty scary thought. We'll learn more about what kind of powers Trump could get.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The last coup d'etat the United States of America sponsored in 2009 in Latin America was under the Obama administration and supported by his Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when they overthrew a mildly social democratic president of Honduras. At that time, the USA denied its role. Today, we are witnessing a quite open and blatant coup d'etat in oil-rich Venezuela against their recently and democratically elected socialist president, Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. boldly announced it no longer considered Maduro the legitimate president of his country. In his stead, the United States of America has recognized José Guaidó, an obscure legislator from the most right-wing of the opposition parties, after Vice President Mike Pence called him on the phone and gave him the blessings of the USA. Venezuelan oil assets in the United States, which amount to over $7 billion, have been frozen. Likewise, its $1 billion plus bank deposits in the United Kingdom have been seized. The United States has succeeded, in the infamous words of former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who engineered the coup against the elected Democratic Socialist President Salvador Allende in Chile on September 11 of 1973. In infamous words, he said he wanted to, quote, make their economy scream. The Venezuelan economy is now half its former size and hobbling along at a depression level. Food and medicine there are increasingly scarce. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to leave their country. Nevertheless, President Maduro has retained popular support, including the support of the Venezuelan army. He is a professor of history at New York University and the author of Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman.
Greg Grandin, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me again.
As between the conflicting claims of legality and legitimacy between Juan Guaido and Nicolas Maduro, whom do you think has a greater claim to the Venezuelan presidency?
Well, that's the question, and that's the matter of interpretation, and it would depend on one's understanding of sovereignty and law and justice. On the one hand, you have Nicolas Maduro, who's the president of the country and the successor to Hugo Chavez, who has authority over the military and claims to have been elected through re-elected in a presidential election last year. On the other hand, you have Juan Guaido, who is claiming, based on a higher notion of sovereignty, a notion of justice, and a notion of the popular will, he is claiming to be president. So you have these very two kind of diametrically opposed notions of sovereignty and justice and where sovereignty lies, and that's in the abstract. If those two positions kind of oppose each other, you also have to kind of bring it down to actually what's going on the ground. Maduro does preside over what many consider a catastrophe, and we could talk about the limits of the Chavista project and how it failed and why it failed in many ways. And on the other hand, Guaido represents not just some abstract popular will, that is actually the name of the political party that he presides over, but he represents a quite extremist current within the opposition that has embarked in various waves, going back to 2002 in some ways, the failed coup against Chavez, to bring about a crisis and a crisis that would destabilize the regime, the government, first Chavez and then Maduro, and they have embarked on protests that have led to deaths and violence. And so I think that on one level there's a struggle over notions of sovereignty and justice, and on another level these two men represent very different political projects that in some ways have become polarized and are unreconcilable.
Greg, do you believe that by recognizing Juan Guaido, the U.S. is pulling off a coup d'etat?
I think that's fairly clear. I think the answer is yes to that question. I think that the coordination between certain sectors of the opposition. Let me just say there was, you know, Guaido represents a current within the opposition that has pushed for a kind of more maximalist opposition to Maduro and wanting to kind of hide in the contradictions and accelerate the crisis until creating these facts on the ground that in which the only resolution would be the downfall of the government. And based on reporting by The Guardian, today there was an article in The Guardian about the connections between not so much Guaido, but Leopoldo Lopez, who is a much more controversial, well-known figure in Venezuela, and his surrogates. Lopez is under house arrest in Caracas, but his surrogates with the Trump administration and the coordination and the pushing for this tactic to claim the presidency after taking charge of the National Assembly. And the Wall Street Journal reported that Mike Pence had urged Guaido to take this tactic to invoke the clause of the Constitution in which he's claiming to be that there's a vacuum of power and that he's the president. I think that that within seconds of doing that, the Trump administration recognized Guaido as president. I think there's no doubt that it's a coup.
What about the oil? Venezuela's got the most oil reserves of any country in the world. And Maduro has claimed that the United States has stolen Venezuela's oil. Do you believe that this is the case?
Well, one has to step back. And there's oil as a kind of natural resource that is essential to the function of the modern political economy. There's oil as a profit, wealth-generating resource that corporations grow rich off. And then there's oil as a kind of lever of geopolitical power. It's clear that Venezuela, it's not about oil in the sense that totally reductionist way, I don't think, but certainly oil structures the relationship between Venezuela and the United States. Venezuela continued to sell oil to the United States throughout the whole of Hugo Chavez's presidency. But what Chavismo did, was it tried to use oil as a geopolitical lever to revive an old developmentalist strategy associated with the new international economic order, that program that emerged out of the UN around third world countries, developing countries, that imagined a more just international economic system based on control of resources, based on fair prices for commodities, and so on. And in many ways, Hugo Chavez was defeated with Reaganism, that project in the 80s, and certainly with Clintonism after the fall of the Berlin Wall and globalization. Why Chavez was a threat, I think, is because he represented a return to that older vision, for good and bad. You know, the idea that third world countries could use petroleum as a tax on the first world in order to make the global economy more just is a questionable premise, particularly since we're living at a moment on the precipice of climate catastrophe. But certainly that's what Chavez did. And there's a lot of criticism of Chavez, easy criticism, that said, well, he just benefited from high oil prices, which is true. But I think that criticism doesn't look at the ways in which that Chavez and his diplomatic team helped revive the price of oil. Right? Oil prices were really low when Chavez was elected. Not just Chavez, but certainly to a large degree led by Chavez's diplomacy, OPEC was revived as a commodity cartel that was able to restabilize its ability to set petroleum prices. And this was a threat to the United States. Oil prices went up. And the response, to a large degree, was, we know the 2002 coup that the Bush administration tried to execute against Chavez, and that failed. But more effectively, what Washington did was it began to the energy revolution that was largely in response to the threat that Venezuela represented, the fracking revolution, trying to get Mexico to liberalize its oil industry, which is state-owned under Pemex. All of these things led to the current collapse of oil prices and ultimately the undermining and destabilization of the Chavista project. So it is about oil, and certainly, after giving that very complicated explanation and historically contextualized explanation, I'm sure there's also more base motives. I mean, I'm sure corporations just want to get in and make money. I'm sure that is also true. And we don't have to, you don't have to read Noam Chomsky to understand this. I mean, Mike Pompeo or John Bolton, they come straight out and say this is about, we're going to open up Venezuelan oil production, that we're already working with Guaido over these issues. I mean, I think that Guaido has renamed the board of directors of Citgo. So now do we not just have Citgo is the oil refinery company and gas station company that is Venezuelan owned that operates in the United States. So not only do we have dueling presidents in Venezuela, we have dueling oil company directors in the United States.
Speaking of John Bolton, he's declared that Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela are tyrannies, just like when Bush called Iraq and Iran the axis of evil. Do you think that Cuba and Nicaragua are in the U.S. sights?
I think they absolutely are. I think that John Bolton has said as much, that this is about, to the degree that it's about oil and to the degree that oil is really about geopolitics, this is also about geopolitics. It's about, the motivations of this, I think, can be understood on multiple levels. And certainly Managua, Nicaragua, and Havana, Cuba are considered maybe perhaps low-hanging fruit. I think that if Venezuela falls, certainly, let me just say that Havana must be making contingency plans as we speak, because they still depend quite a bit, despite how bad the crisis is in Venezuela. Venezuela is still fairly forthcoming with aid, including energy aid to assistance to Cuba. So I think it's fairly clear that Washington or a certain cohort within Washington would like to push this further. I mean, this is the larger context of this is the taking back of Latin America. I mean, just 10 years ago, the region was governed by a spectrum of left governments that offered real opposition to not just the Washington consensus, but Washington leadership when it came to Washington militarism, when it came to its Middle East policy, for instance. I think Nacio Lula da Silva, the president of Brazil, Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, Evo Morales, along with other left leaders, roundly rejected U.S. the premises of U.S.'s policy in the Middle East and elsewhere. And what we've seen is a complete rollback of that, starting with Honduras, the coup in 2009, but moving on quickly through other countries, Paraguay and elections in Chile and Argentina, and then what has to be called a coup in Brazil against the Workers' Party. Lula is in jail. Dilma, his successor, Rousseff, was impeached. This is and just a few months ago, we saw the election of Jair Bolsonaro, who is an out-and-out fascist on many levels. I mean, he's perhaps one of the scariest world leaders, and Brazil is a powerhouse. And this has led to a realignment in Latin America that's staggering in the quickness in which it happened. And certainly what's going on in Venezuela wouldn't have been possible without that alignment. And what is happening in Venezuela is, I think, meant to further that alignment and solidify it.
Speaking of scary people, I wanted to ask you about Elliot Abrams, who's been given the position of overseeing what's going on in Venezuela. And I wanted to ask you to please sketch for our listeners Elliot Abrams' sordid background.
You know, the U.S. is at that moment where I guess any pretense of moralism or legitimacy or righteousness is just Bolton and Pompeo and Elliot Abrams, for these people to be claiming that they're acting in Venezuela motivated by concerns about democracy is and human rights is quite ludicrous. Elliot Abrams was the Assistant Secretary of State to Ronald Reagan for human rights, and he was key in justifying Reagan's death squad policies in El Salvador, in Guatemala, in Honduras. He was deeply involved in that complex of activities that fall under the name of Iran-Contra, and he was indicted in Iran-Contra and then pardoned by George H.W. Bush. He helped cover up the El Mazote massacre, for instance, in El Salvador in 1980, which was one of the worst single-day human rights atrocities on record. He has blood on his hand, and he circles back and cycles back into U.S. foreign policy repeatedly. I mean, he was in George W. Bush's administration as a Middle Eastern advisor. I think he's the link between the Middle East and Latin America as a terrain for neoconservatives to exert their influence.
Greg, where did Juan Guaido come from? He was an obscure figure in a far-right party. All of a sudden, he's been named president by the USA. Tell us about him.
Well, I know. It's quite amazing. So in Venezuela, there's a conflict. The opposition won the National Assembly 3 years ago, I think, in 2015. They won a majority, a clear majority. And this was part of the deterioration for the polarization. Maduro sought to disempower and disenfranchise the National Assembly as part of his consolidation. I wouldn't say consolidation of power, because his hold on power is, I think, quite tenuous. And then the opposition parties agreed to rotate the presidency of the National Assembly, and he, over the last couple of years, and he's the leader of a party called the Popular Will Party. It was his turn to be the president, and hence this plan was hatched. He's young, I'm in the 30s, I can't remember exactly how old he is, 39, 35, something like that. But the important thing is that behind him, and this is, I would refer listeners to an article, a report that was just published in The Guardian today, is Leopoldo López, who is a much more well-known, notorious opposition figure, who is in jail, house arrest, serving a 14-year sentence for his involvement in protests that led to the deaths of numerous Venezuelans after Maduro's first election and after Chavez's death. López is much more discredited. López is known to have ties to deep reactionary currents within Venezuelan society, and his ambition is kind of boundless. It's fairly, it's clear that he wants to be president. And the Guardian report makes the case and provides the links between López and Guaido and López as really being the person who's orchestrating a lot of this through his surrogates in Washington, who have developed close relations with the Trump administration.
Russia and China are opposing the American move. Does this weigh like a feather in the balance, or might they actually be successful?
Well, this speaks to the earlier question about geopolitics that events in Venezuela reveal and are motivated by multiple currents, and one of them is, I think, about the Trump administration's attempt to stake out this geopolitical line in the sand with, on the one hand, particularly China. I think it might have more to do with China than Russia. China's investment in Africa and Latin America and its increasing economic influence and power in those countries has been a worry to certain cohorts within Washington for quite a while. And part of Bolsonaro, for instance, his appeal and his campaign promises is to roll back China's influence in Brazil, which has become considerable. So in some ways, this might be laying down a marker about China in Latin America, maybe more than Russia. Whether this will have a difference, you know, it's not just China and Russia, but Mexico and Uruguay and Bolivia, and I think even Ecuador are calling for mediation in Venezuela, and I think Maduro is agreeing and working more with those countries as a way to find maybe a lifeline to get out of this crisis in a way that doesn't entail the coming to power of the most reactionary maximalist caucus within the opposition.
Greg, is what the USA doing to Venezuela right now illegal under the charters of the United Nations and the Organization of American States?
You guys are lawyers. I would think it is, but I mean, this is a question of where interpretation gives way to power, right? And realpolitik. US has been doing the U.S. has been appealing for, the U.S. bombed Libya in 1986 by appealing to, which would seem to be a violation of the United Nations charter, but the U.S. managed to spin it as a question of self-defense. My understanding is that in addition to justifications such as human rights and democracy, the Trump administration is also talking about Iran and Hezbollah in Venezuela, and this is a question of continental self-defense and national security. So I would think that any impartial interpretation of those two charters would understand it as to be a violation of those two charters, but I think that interpretation is also often subordinated to these larger issues of power, and which always finds room for justification.
Venezuela's sovereignty is at risk. Do you believe that also at risk is the right of any country in Latin America, or in the world for that matter, to be able to determine for itself what kind of a social and political arrangement it shall have?
Well, certainly. I mean, one could imagine that the road to Tehran runs through Caracas, and the road to Managua or Havana, your detour through Managua. I mean, there's been an erosion of the concept of sovereignty, at least since the invasion of Panama in 1989. My understanding is that was the first post-cold. I mean, that just happened a few days after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it was justified. It was the first military operation that was justified in the name of some higher morality, namely democracy and human rights, rather than national security or anti-communism, and that was the beginning of the erosion of the ideal of sovereignty. I mean, I think the erosion of that ideal takes place along many vectors. There's Iraq, there's the human rights movement, there's campaigns against genocide. It's not a clear-cut correlation between the interests of power and the erosion of sovereignty. But I think there is certainly a loose correlation between those two things, and the United States' assumption to decide what sovereign is an assumption long-standing. That's been, in some ways, it's a return to earlier 19th century notions of sovereignty, in which the United States intervenes in order to protect property, in order to dislodge rulers that they feel can't protect its interests. And I think that in some ways we've returned to that order. And it's not Venezuela. I mean, that was Iraq. That was Libya. I think there's all sorts of ways in which the notion of the ideal of sovereignty has been eroded.
Do you think that the talk about the supposed lack of democracy in Cuba and in Venezuela is simply a cover for Washington's goal of rolling back all the social and political progress that's been made in Latin America since the Cuban Revolution of 1959?
I would inquire as to the motives behind claiming to be defending human rights and democracy. I mean, I think the United States certainly uses those justifications as a fig leaf in order to exert its power. I mean, all you have to do is look at the hypocrisy. I mean, Saudi Arabia, I mean, Guaido is riding around, according to the New York Times, on the back of a motorcycle across Caracas. I mean, Saudi Arabia just recently allowed women to drive. I mean, you know, so in terms of who the United States picks to decide who's violating human rights and who's not, it's fairly obvious that, I mean, it's not that complicated. I mean, look in Latin America, just look at the United States is eroding and supporting these corrupt, abusive regime in Guatemala as it undermines the United Nations a structure which has been set up to get at corruption and protect human rights. So all you have to do is look at the hypocrisy between, say, the Trump administration's policy towards Guatemala and its policy towards Venezuela to know that the variable is not concern for human rights and democracy that motivates U.S. foreign policy.
Greg, we just have a few minutes remaining. With a handful of exceptions like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, the Democratic Party is in complete collusion with the Trump administration. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, this is the other level on which these kind of interventions operate. Aside from oil, aside from geopolitics, there's the ways in which these, you know, interventions and projections of power serve to reorder domestic politics and silence critics. I mean, Venezuela in particular has long been a kind of proxy for the Republicans and the right to assert a certain kind of cohesive moral vision of the relationship between individual rights and property rights, and casting social rights and economic rights as somehow perverse. And that has only become even more so. And the Democrats don't have to a large degree, the Democrats, who are totally complicit in all of the sanctions regime that started actually under the Obama administration that has contributed to the misery of Venezuelans. I mean, I don't want to say it's the main cause, certainly not. There's a lot of blame to go around, but the Democratic Party, the Democratic leadership is certainly complicit in the sanctioning of Venezuela that has led to this crisis. So they're not in much of a position to criticize when things like this happen. And so, yeah, so yes, it's interesting the way that Venezuela, I mean, you saw it in the State of the Union address, a totally clumsy, perfunctory pivot where I was waiting and waiting and was wondering when Trump was going to mention Venezuela, and then he mentions Venezuela, and then he immediately pivots to the Alejandria Ocasio-Cortez wing of the Democratic Party. There will never be socialism in this country. I mean, it was heavy-handed and clumsy. I don't know how effective it was, but it is a perfect example of the way foreign policy is used to establish hegemony not only over other countries, but within this country, a kind of moral vision for how social relations should be organized and what's considered legitimate and what's considered perverse. And I think that the Democratic Party is complicit. Obviously, we could talk about the material reasons why the Democratic Party, you know, its corporate funders, its, you know, it's the dead hand of the Clintons on the Democratic Party and Clintonianism. But I think that if there is an ascendant realignment within the Democratic Party, it's got to realize, it's got to understand, it can't get caught off guard by these kind of foreign policy crises. It has to be sure in its response. And we haven't seen that. We've seen, you know, aside from a few, as you mentioned, a handful of representatives, we've seen much actual applause. Dick Durbin, I mean, who would have thought Dick Durbin has had so much at stake in Venezuela? I didn't even realize, but he's cheering the Trump administration. You know, it's Elliot Engel, and then this gets, of course, the motives for all of this get filtered through Middle East politics and everything that goes with it and the Democratic Party's own schisms. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, sure will. Greg Grandin, we're out of our allotted time. Heidi and I are very grateful for your enlightening thoughts. And before we let you go, though, we know you've got a new book coming out. Could you mention the title and tell us a bit about it?
Oh, it's called The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. And it's an attempt to understand how the U.S. moved from having the frontier, which symbolized a kind of openness and moving out in the world and the future, how that myth has been supplanted by the border wall. Right? And the argument is that the United States has exhausted the ability to use expansion as a way to organize domestic politics, the endless war, economic inequality, and standing on the precipice of environmental collapse has closed the frontier for good and led to a kind of turning inward, which explains Trumpism.
Well, good for you. We're looking forward to talking to you about the book when it comes out, and we thank you so much, Greg Grandin, for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks so much, Mike. Thanks so much, Heidi. It was really a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you, Greg. Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
United States presidents have the discretion to declare a national emergency. As soon as they do, they can sidestep many existing limits to presidential authority. In fact, 136 or more special provisions become available. Some of these provisions give reasonable responses to real emergencies, while others seem to bolster the power of a so-called unitary executive who wants to amass or retain power. The president can activate laws allowing him to, for example, shut down many kinds of electronic communications inside the U.S., or freeze Americans' bank accounts. Other powers are available without a declaration of emergency, including laws that allow the president to deploy troops inside the country to quell domestic unrest. The rationale for having emergency powers is simple. The government's ordinary powers may not be enough in times of crisis. Amending the laws to provide greater ones would just take too long. Emergency powers are intended to give a temporary boost until the emergency passes or there is time to change the law through the regular legislative process. The problem comes when presidents don't have the best interest of the country in mind. Joining us to discuss emergency presidential powers is Andrew Boyd, counsel at the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Andrew spent 7 years prosecuting senior Khmer Rouge leaders on behalf of the United Nations for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. He also worked on cases resulting from the 1994 Rwandan genocide at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Andrew Boyd, welcome to Law and Disorder. Andrew Boyd, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Andrew, what does the U.S. Constitution say about what rights a president may suspend during national emergency?
Well, actually, the U.S. Constitution itself doesn't give the president any right to suspend the rights of citizens during national emergencies. The Constitution is very sparse in its discussion of emergency powers, but it does discuss emergency powers in one place, in Article 1, and it talks about the ability to suspend habeas corpus, the ability of someone who has been arrested to challenge that arrest before an impartial judiciary, but that is ascribed to Congress, not to the president.
Underlying emergency presidential powers is the assumption that the chief executive will act in the country's best interest. What if a president declares an emergency because he faces something like impeachment or he just wants to retain his power?
That's right. That type of situation would be an abuse of powers that many countries have given to the executive to use in times of true emergencies. Because emergencies are difficult to predict, legislatures will often say that they want an executive to have certain powers that they wouldn't ordinarily have for a short amount of time to deal with those emergencies, and they have to pass those laws in advance because the idea is there may not be time to pass those laws when the emergency actually happens. It does rely on a certain amount of good faith exercise by the president. In the past, that has mostly been true, although not entirely. But when you have a president who is blatantly willing to use these powers in circumstances that do not constitute an emergency, there's a clear concern about circumventing of checks and balances that undergird our entire democracy.
Well, let's talk about what is an emergency. For example, is there an emergency situation now at our southern border, as Trump sought to convince the American people the other night? Is that an emergency that he could use to declare a state of emergency?
Well, that is what he is threatening to do. I think objectively, factually, it's pretty clear that the immigration situation does not constitute an emergency for quite a number of reasons. First of all, illegal immigration across the southern border is at historic lows when you look back at recent years. In addition, it hasn't been a sudden change in immigration. Immigration is an issue that has been debated for years now, and including in the last Congress, where Congress also declined to provide President Trump with the funding that he requested for building the wall. Indeed, the very fact that the president has been so blatantly clear that he would use emergency powers only if he couldn't get the wall funded through Congress itself speaks to the fact that this is not an unforeseen emergency that's going to pop up suddenly. It's that he's trying to use these powers or would potentially use these powers to get around Congress and Congress's power of the purse, and that would not be appropriate under the spirit, certainly, of the National Emergencies Act, which is the governing law.
Well, in addition to getting money for building his wall, what other things might Trump do if he declares a state of emergency?
Oh, sure. Well, so here at the Brennan Center, we've done a fair amount of research on emergency powers. The president has access to over 136 particular laws once he declares a national emergency, or whether once a national emergency is declared. Over 90 of those are available to him simply by him declaring a national emergency. Some other ones require an additional step for that to occur. And these emergencies run the gamut. And I should mention that President Trump has already declared at least three national emergencies during his term, and other presidents have declared national emergencies as well. There are currently 31 national emergencies actually in effect, which is something that many people don't realize, and these use various aspects of these powers. But some of the scariest powers that are available to the president when he declares a national emergency include the ability to seize radio stations, the ability to sanction individuals, including persons within the United States, prohibiting them from having bank accounts or earning money, and even testing of biological and chemical weapon persons. So there are some scary powers out there that a president could potentially use if he was so inclined.
Andrew, how does he actually do this? Does he issue a directive declaring an emergency, and is that public information that we could look for somewhere?
Yes, it is. Under the National Emergencies Act, which was passed in 1976, the president is required to declare a national emergency, to transmit that declaration to Congress, and to post it in the Federal Register. The National Emergencies Act of 1976, although it is fairly bare bones and we would argue is ripe for Congress to revisit and revise to place greater controls on national emergencies, was actually enacted at the time because of concerns over executive abuse of emergency powers. At the time, prior to the National Emergencies Act, the president had a lot of leeway to declare a national emergency and not a lot of transparency. As soon as he declared a national emergency, he had access to over 400 powers, statutory powers, and he didn't have to say which ones he was using or how he was using them. And so Congress said, okay, enough of that. We're going to put some more procedural requirements on you, including the necessity for you to publicly declare this, place it in the Federal Register, but also tell us which of the particular powers you're going to use under this national emergency. So the president has to say, I declare a national emergency, and I'm going to use such and such statutory code that enables me to do X, Y, and Z.
I read about something called presidential emergency action documents. Can you talk about those briefly? I heard that Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North may have actually worked with FEMA in the past to control the U.S., to have it turned over to FEMA during a national crisis. What are those action documents, and are those available to the public?
If I may, I'll take it from the back end, because while I'm certainly interested in learning more about the presidential emergency action documents or directives, they, as far as I know, and as far as my research has turned up in our research at the Brennan Center, none of those have ever been made public, even though they have been there have been versions of them since sometime in the 1950s, and they are continuously updated, possibly to this day, certainly up through the last administration, because we see them referenced in various documents. For example, in budget submissions that the Department of Justice has submitted to Congress, they talk about the Office of Legal Counsel being engaged in a project to update presidential emergency active directives. And what these documents are, as far as we can gather from the outside, is a series of executive orders and other types of orders that are ready to go in certain types of emergencies, whereby the president can exercise powers. Now, what powers he is claiming he can exercise under those, we don't know, because these documents are classified and none have ever been made public. In the past, we know that there have been descriptions of these documents which have talked about people on lists that would be automatically arrested if these documents were utilized. So there's potentially some very scary stuff in there. You know, there's other than internal executive branch analysis, we don't know how much executive presidential power they claim to be exercising, whether they would be upheld in courts or not during a time of emergency. So it's certainly an area that we think an area where more transparency is necessary.
What scares me is the possibility that the president could deploy armed forces, American troops, inside of this country, do what they call law and order. I'm thinking, what if there was a huge social upheaval in this country? Could the president call out the American Army or the Marines to enforce his will?
Well, there are some restrictions on that. There is a law dating from the Civil War, the post-Civil War era, called the Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibits the use of American military domestically to engage in law enforcement. There are exceptions to that and some ways around that. For example, as you may be aware, the president, including in his State of the Union address, discussed the deployment of troops to the southern border. Those troops are not subject to the Posse Comitatus Act under the view of the administration because they are not engaged in law enforcement. For example, they are reportedly engaged in building fences and providing potentially medical aid and support to Department of Homeland Security forces that are at the border, but they're not themselves engaged in law enforcement and therefore don't fall under the Posse Comitatus Act. However, there are other other laws, such as the Insurrection Act, which would allow the president, under certain circumstances, ostensibly, to use the military to put down insurrection within the United States as defined under that act. That's certainly another area where a bad faith actor could potentially abuse those powers, and another area where we think Congress should revisit and potentially place greater checks.
Andrew, talk about economic powers during an emergency. Can the president shut down the assets of individuals and organizations? And I'm assuming, since we know there are lists of people who might be targeted, that that could be a venue he pursues?
That's correct. The president does have that power under an act called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. And in fact, that act, for short, which is called IEPA, is the most commonly used emergency power by any president since the National Emergencies Act was passed in 1976. It has been used in all except for a couple of the declared, of the I think some over 50 declared emergencies that presidents have declared since that time. Mostly, however, it is used in regards to persons outside of the United States. So, for example, sometimes it's even used in relation to alleged human rights abusers in other countries in order to seize their assets. However, it has been used in the past to target individuals within the United States. And the powers under this act are so broad that it could essentially economically paralyze someone, prohibit them from being able to earn money or receive money in any way that would allow them to buy food or to rent an apartment, et cetera, et cetera. The use of these powers within the United States obviously raises tremendous due process concerns under the Constitution for the ability to challenge these types of sanctions in court and to see what evidence is being used against an individual. And in fact, it was challenged, and in a couple of federal court cases, judges have raised these due process concerns and said, you know, this. The application of these laws within the United States without the proper due process measures raises serious constitutional issues. However, once judges started raising these issues, past administrations backed down from using them within the United States, so it never reached the Supreme Court.
We're speaking with Attorney Andrew Boyd from the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Andrew, I wanted to ask you if you're aware of the lawsuit that Noam Chomsky and Chris Hedges brought here in New York back in 2016. In federal court, Judge Catherine Forrest heard it, and it was brought to challenge the National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1021, which allows for the use of the president to use troops domestically for law enforcement within the United States. Forrest heard witnesses, and she declared in favor of Hedges and Chomsky, whereupon the government sought to appeal the case to the Court of Appeals. Before the Court of Appeals could hear it, the attorneys for Chomsky and Hedges went down to D.C. and they spoke with Nancy Pelosi, and they said, if you'll remove the powers of the president to rendition American citizens and put them away forever, if you'll take that out of the law, we'll drop the lawsuit. And Pelosi said no, she wouldn't do it. And Chris Hedges concluded from that they know what's coming. And I wanted to know if you were aware of this and what your thoughts are on it.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that lawsuit. It would be difficult for me to comment on it.
Well, let's move along.
Andrew, we've heard talk of the president using the so-called kill switch to curtail internet access. Do you think that is a possibility if he declares an emergency?
So the interpretation of the a section of the Communications Act, some persons within the administration have alleged give them the power that would potentially give them the power to take or seize control of parts of the internet you know, that's an interpretation that hasn't, to my knowledge, been fully challenged in court, and it's an interpretation based off of laws that predate the internet. I should also mention it's not explicitly an emergency power. That is, that particular power that potentially could give a president, or that some interpret to give the president power to control the internet, is a power that is available through a declaration of the potential for war, not through a national emergency declaration. But that is some small comfort, because obviously a president who's willing to abuse national emergency powers might also be willing to abuse those types of powers. And clearly, we see this in foreign countries where persons who feel their power is being threatened control parts of the internet, because the internet is obviously a huge aspect of political campaigns, of communication campaigns, and things like that. I certainly don't want to speculate as to, you know, how President Trump might act in the future, or another executive. These laws are on the books and have been on the books, and unless they're reformed, will be on the books for years to come. And so I don't want to speculate about how they might be used in the future. The concern of the American people, the concern of Congress, should be that there aren't sufficient checks on a bad faith actor to use them in this way. I think, you know, one silver lining of Trump's threat to use emergency powers in such a bad faith way is that it has brought this issue to the fore. It has made the public aware that there are these laws out there that don't have sufficient checks and balances, and that there's these areas are ripe for reform.
What concerns me is what the Supreme Court might do. Let's say that Trump does call a national emergency. The matter is quickly brought in front of the Supreme Court with the addition of Kavanaugh and Justice Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. You have people that are inclined to give a wide berth to executive authority and executive power. Does that concern you, Andrew?
It absolutely does. The federal judiciary is typically very deferential to the executive when they are dealing with issues of national defense, national emergency. So that would be one aspect of any such case that would surround this. We've also seen just last term that the Supreme Court in the Trump v. Hawaii case, which is also referred to as the Muslim ban case, and this was the Supreme Court before Justice Kavanaugh joined, was willing to look past statements that the president had made that clearly indicated his true motivation for the particular executive act that was being challenged, and they were willing to take on face value administration claims regarding the processes that they went through in order to determine which countries persons from which countries should not be granted visas. You have a somewhat similar situation here, where the president is clearly telegraphing that he would be using emergency powers in a way that they were not supposed to be used, in a way to sort of get around Congress's power of the purse. But the question is, you know, would the Supreme Court consider those statements and those tweets from the president, or would they just look at whatever the Department of Justice puts up there and says is the reasoning behind the use of the national emergency powers? And, you know, what would actually happen is anyone's guess. So I should also mention that any legal challenge to a declaration of national emergency, and specifically to try to obtain money to build the wall, would not only focus on whether the national emergency declaration was appropriate, but also whether the particular statutory powers that the president is claiming to use to move money around, whether those are being used in an appropriate way.
Andrew, how can our listeners learn more about this and read some of what you've written and about the work that you're doing at the Brennan Center?
Well, certainly you can visit our website, where you will find a lot of our analysis on emergency powers. That's BrennanCenter.org. You can also, I would advise your listeners to look for an article in the Atlantic magazine that my colleague Liza Goitein wrote regarding emergency powers. And you will also be able to find, we presented a symposium this month on emergency powers. Some of that was broadcast on C-SPAN, so you should be able to find that. And we will shortly have some video of that on our website as well for your listeners to be able to watch.
Andrew Boyd, it's really been a pleasure, albeit a slightly disturbing one, to have you join us on Law and Disorder. And we thank you and your colleagues for your excellent work in this field.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I hope that there's no national emergency and we don't have to call you back right away. Thank you so much, Andrew Boyd. You take it easy.
All right, you too.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.